Well, we only have a very short time together this afternoon, so I wanted to share with you a few basic insights into the way that pornography is shaping our society, and in that process, actually impacting millions of individuals and the relationships that those individuals value. Now, I have a favorite speaker who once said, "You don't need a whole bunch of great ideas to change your life. You just need one good idea that you're actually prepared to use." So that's what I wanted to do this afternoon, is I wanted to leave you with one or two really useful insights that you can take forward into your home or professional life. I'll give you a load of free stuff at the end of this, as well as my contact details. And if you'd like me to work with your organization or business, then we can have that conversation too. So let's begin. Look, what I've been trying to do for some time on television and radio is to shift the debate about pornography from questions of, you know, morality and ethics to questions of public health. And I'll get to that, the issue of public health, in a moment. Now, to some of you, this will seem problematic. For those of you in the room who view pornography through the lens of what I would call monotheistic personalism, you know, basically you're a person who is a person of faith and has a strong religious outlook, you know, there's not much point having a discussion about whether pornography is immoral or unethical. We agree that it's a problem because in pornography, the human person is fragmented and viewed in a utilitarian sense instead of being created or seen as being created in the imago Dei, or in the image of God. Excuse me. So the person in what we see in pornography is reduced to their body parts and the capacity of those body parts to service the sexual arousal of third parties. You know, over the years, I get in all sorts of discussions with people around what constitutes pornography. And, you know, I often say, well, one person's pornography is another person's art. And, you know, you don't have to agree with these, but a couple of great insights is simply that, you know, great art of the human body, it sort of elevates the viewer into contemplation of the beauty of the human form, and usually through that contemplation to the divine. Whereas pornography is much simpler. Pornography effectively functions to create sexual arousal. So you can see the difference there between art and the kind of purely biophysiological aspect of pornography. But also what I've done here and was sort of wanting to share with you today is that, you know, it's not just the person reduced to their body parts. It's the capacity of those body parts being used to service the sexual arousal of third parties who are not present. It's a really useful sort of insight into how we could sort of, you know, conceptualize the difference of pornography. So I think one of the best encapsulations of this idea comes from Pope John Paul II, who said something really quite powerful, and I can hope you can listen to this. He said, "The problem with pornography is not that it shows too much, but rather that it shows too little." I mean, listen to that again, you know, write that down. The problem with pornography is not that it shows too much, but rather that it shows too little. You know, the fullness of what a person is, you know, their emotional, spiritual, biopsychophysiological, psychological self is sort of hidden from the viewer, and the person is broken down to just their sexual aspect alone. So while I'm indulging myself in some of my favorite quotes, I think British philosopher Roger Scruton cuts to the very core of our cultural problems with sex when he says this. It's another really powerful quote. He says, "Sex is either consecration or desecration, with no middle ground in between." Isn't that powerful? We have to agree with it again, but it's quite a... Scruton does this frequently, these sort of very powerful one-liners. Sex is either consecration or desecration, with no middle ground in between. Now, so if you try and have a discussion with people about the moral questions presented by pornography, you'll run into another issue that the brilliant academic and philosopher Alistair MacIntyre discusses in his book, After Virtue. And now, what sort of MacIntyre gets at is that we simply no longer have a shared language around morality, because the entire framework of faith and reason has been undone by certain aspects of the Enlightenment. Now, it is recovering, but it will take a long time. All that this means is that trying to convince people you know, people who aren't people of faith or may not have a religious worldview. Trying to convince them that pornography is bad for them is going to be a bit harder than it should be for probably the next few hundred years. Now, I'm an optimist. My second master's degree taught me to think in 500-year time blocks. So I'm in for the long haul. But basically, we're going to see, you know this. You know that you just can't sort of come up to somebody and say you shouldn't use pornography because you'll go to hell. I mean, people are like, whatever. You know, you can't judge me, man. You can tell me nothing. Now, people don't like to be told that. So really what we want to do is, you know, if you're in the context of a discussion of spirituality, then sure, you could include aspects of morality and ethics. But what I'm doing today is talking about a more broad, more general understanding of how we could communicate to people, to media, to the public square, a new understanding of the impact of pornography. So the good news, however, if there is any in this whole sad landscape of what pornography does to people, is that we're now seeing a vast and growing body of peer-reviewed empirical data on just what pornography does to the human brain and how that impact shapes behaviors and what those behaviors will mean for your home, your workplace, or your church. This is what I mean, by the way, that I've been trying to move the debate toward public health. That's where we have the data. And unfortunately, though, the problem is that no matter how good the data, a lot of very powerful people want to ensure that we ignore the science. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because a lot of our elites, in public service and stuff, and government and academia, really want to, you know, they sort of deify science, and that if science says X, then it must be true. Except it seems the science around pornography addiction and why. Now, my suggestion is because if we follow the science, it's going to force those in power to confront much deeper issues. The science would actually force many of our elites to reconsider their wholesale support for the sexual revolution. So basically, once you sort of look at the data and begin to see what pornography does, then it'll force you to look at really core questions about, you know, human happiness, sexual intimacy, relationships between persons on a sexual level. And to sort of follow the conclusion of what pornography is doing in that space would contravene a lot of the great mantras of the sexual revolution. So let's move on. I want to give you now a kind of interesting historical parallel that kind of then shows where we are at the moment with the scientific data on pornography. So, you know, back in the 1950s, some bright spark had a bit of an idea. They noticed that all these people smoking two packs a day seemed to have a strange habit of dying. Funny that. How could inhaling a huge cocktail of carcinogenic compounds 80 times a day cause anyone grief? So they began to quietly suggest that maybe there was a link. No, said Big Tobacco and government. The popular press went along, Hollywood, Marlboro Man, and just about everyone else. That's a ridiculous idea. Be quiet, you fundamentalist, trying to ruin everyone's smoking fun with your moral crusade. Unfortunately, lots of people kept up this inconvenient habit of dying when they smoked a lot, and it also cost a hell of a lot of money in public health costs and, of course, lost productivity because your workers don't tend to be quite as productive when they're dying sort of 25 or 30 years before they would normally die. But Big Tobacco leaned back in that big government-funded cozy chair, blew a smoke ring and laughed, "Prove it!" Tens of millions more people had to die, but eventually the quiet voice of science and reason won the day. So we don't have a public debate anymore going, you know, is smoking bad for people? You know, we don't have that debate anymore because the data sort of really came to the fore. And is it an exact replica of what's happening with pornography? No, but I think there's some strong parallels. Why? Because, for example, in 2013, we know that pornography massively stimulates the release of the neurochemical D2 dopamine. Now, overproduction of D2 dopamine then triggers the overproduction of another neurochemical called delta-fos-B, which actually eats gray matter in the prefrontal cortex. The best introductory text, or one of the best introductory texts on this, is Judith Reisman's The Psychopharmacology of Pictorial Pornography Addiction. So we now have a vast body of data on how imagery causes neurochemical and neuroplastic change in the human brain. That's a really important point. You know, that we sort of think that what we see is neutral and that we apply categories to it. So, you know, it doesn't matter what you show to anybody, then, you know, it's just how they interpret it. But we actually can see that certain imagery creates biophysiological arousal and neurochemical change in the brain. I remember years ago reading stuff from The Lancet where, you know, I think it was a Professor Brown was talking about the, you know, arousal rates in children when they're exposed to violent imagery. So the data is coming in that what we see, what we look at, has an effect on our physiology and our neurochemistry. So, you know, the impact of this reduction in gray matter, which we call hyperfrontality, is seen in two key issues. One, huge problems with impulse control, and also an inability to foresee consequences. That's no surprise, given as the prefrontal cortex is kind of the executive center of the human brain. You know, and the issue around impulse control goes to another one of the great battlegrounds around pornography. You know, does pornography cause sexual crime? Well, of course, we don't know that, because it's very hard in the sciences to prove a kind of direct causal relationship between seeing something and doing something. I accept that totally. But, you know, if we know that at a sort of neurochemical level, heavy pornography addiction is causing problems with impulse control and an inability to foresee consequences, well, is that so surprising when we see a rise in sexual crime? If people are struggling with their impulse control and their inability to foresee consequences, then I think we can begin to at least have a discussion around what extreme pornographic content might be doing. So a 2011 study called Microstructure Abnormalities in Adolescents with Internet Addiction Disorder states, here's the exact quote, researchers found a 10 to 20% reduction in frontal cortex gray matter. I mean, think about that. 10 to 20% of the prefrontal cortex being reduced, being eaten by neurochemical overproduction by what people are watching. Now, in terms of how widespread these addictive problems are likely to become, we have a veritable tsunami of data. Nielsen research in the first quarter of 2009 showed over 4 million Australians accessing hardcore online content. The recent British Independent Parliamentary Inquiry into online child protection data shows 4 out of 5 16-year-olds accessing pornographic content weekly. A little over 30%, give or take, we'll hear different numbers on this all the time, of internet traffic is pornography related. The largest study ever conducted of internet addiction shows 14% of Chinese adolescents already in the category of full-blown addiction. So run the numbers on that one. It's a big country. Now, 10 to 20% frontal lobe loss for 14% of Chinese teenagers. And of course, I mean, look at the uptake of the internet, violent gaming and pornography addiction. We're not going to see those numbers go down for a while. So a common response is, but look, it's not a substance, it's not a drug, it can't be addictive. Well, crucially, in 2011, the American Society of Addiction Medicine added sex to its categories as biologically addictive and stated altered biology affects subsequent behavior. So think of that again. This is the peak body for addiction medicine. You know, just 2 years ago, introduced the category of sex as an addiction, as biologically addictive, and tells us that the changes in biology affect subsequent behavior. So you can see the train now between highly arousing imagery causing neurochemical and neuroplastic change in the brain and then causing subsequent behavioral change. So what I wanted to do to finish was just, because this was only a very short presentation today, was to give you, you know, to flesh this out with some more really good data. Now, this is from Dr. Nora Volko, who's the director for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And this is her direct quote. The Institute's name, the name of the Institute of which she's the director, should encompass, her words, addictions such as pornography. Now, this is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse saying we need to include pornography as one of the addictions now that we actually address. Columbia University psychiatrist and neuroplasticity expert Dr. Norman Doidge, who's the author of the famous The Brain That Changes Itself. Listen to his words, direct quote. "The addictiveness of internet pornography is not a metaphor, but long-term, sometimes lifelong, neuroplastic change in the brain." UCLA Berkeley Emeritus Professor Philip Zimbardo, a direct quote here, "Brains are being digitally rewired in a new way for change, novelty, excitement, and constant arousal." Okay, so all of that was the good news, depending on what you think of it. I'm personally quite excited. You can hear the animation in my voice. It's because we're getting the data. We're actually, you know, I remember appearing on television once, and you know, this panel just wanted to reduce it to moral judgments and you can't tell anybody what to do. I'm going, well, screw that, friends. What we can do is look at the data, look at the, you know, the PET scans, the CAT scans, the, you know, the stuff that we can actually see in the human brain happening when people are devoting hours and hours of their time to this highly arousing pornographic content. So are we going to ban it all? No, I think, especially with children, it's crucial to put in place as many barriers as we can so they're not inadvertently exposed to content. But I think the future is in really having a cultural discussion around this sort of scientific data and helping parents and educators and legislators and the judicial system to go, wow, you know, when we just mainstream this stuff into a culture, you know, here's what happens. So to finish, I want to give you a couple of dot points. You know, grab all the free stuff off me today. I'm going to be at the back of the room. Grab what you want to grab. I'm going to talk again tomorrow on the sort of impact on pornography addiction inside marriage. And, you know, speaking on this topic around the world, I've just had so many conversations, often with men, sometimes with women, around what this addiction is doing inside relationships. So I want you to come to that tomorrow. Get my card, download this talk, go to my other site, stopusingpornography.com. Learn as much about this topic as you can, especially the addiction science, because that really impacts people. So we just want to, you know, go to Google Alerts, set yourself up an alert in there so you can look at some data as it comes through. Create, number five here, create a workplace policy and education and training session. So if you're in big government, healthcare, education, if you know big corporate or big government, we've really got to be talking to staff around this, around their usage policies, around understanding what it does. And I can help you as a consultant with that. So if you're hearing this talk, then you might be hearing the recording, just send me an email and we can talk about getting me out there to do some presentations and helping your whole community really understand what this issue is doing. So finally, make a decision to love and to simply be a good person. Be a person who values the inherent dignity of the human person, the sacredness of sex, and the common bonds that have always and may yet still hold our societies together.